And Suna was the first one up the stairs, using the flashlight on her phone to illuminate the crawlspace. This amazed Maud. "That thing is a phone and a Google and a flashlight? That's incredible." Suna smirked. "That's just the tip of the iceberg, my dear Maudikins." Maud didn't seem to appreciate being called Maudikins, but her scowl was not nearly so severe as it had once been, and all she said was, "You and your nicknames." Mackenzie and Maud waited on the stairs as Suna crept on ahead. "Hmm," they heard from above. "Interesting."
"What? What's interesting?"
Maud was impatient. They heard several quick thumping noises as Suna pounded on the walls with her fists, and then her head appeared again in the opening.
"Mac, can you shine your light up here too?"
"You have a flashlight phone too, Mackenzie?"
Maud asked. Mackenzie smiled.
"Yep."
She hopped up a step, nervous about getting closer to the haunted attic, but anxious to get the whole thing over with. She turned her light on and shined it into the crawl space. Suna was in a corner. She pushed on one wall and then on the other.
"Check it out."
She pointed at the floor.
"It looks like there's been traffic here, right? I mean, other than me. I guess now you can't really tell the difference. But anyway, these walls aren't budging. The way that it looked when I first came here, it was like someone came back here and scuffled around a bit, but..."
"Did you push on the ceiling?" Mackenzie asked.
"Oh! Ha! I didn't even think of that. Duh!"
Suna pushed up, and then let out a gasp when the roof gave way. She let it fall back down again with a soft crack. Her eyes grew wide in the glow of the flashlight.
"I found something," she whispered. "I think."
Mackenzie felt a thrill run up her neck. She doubled over, suddenly out of breath.
"What do you mean?" she managed. "Like you found a... an... you found..."
"You were right, Mac."
Suna pushed on the wooden panel above her head again, a little harder this time.
"This panel is on hinges. It's like a door on the ceiling, minus the knob."
Mackenzie watched, transfixed, as Suna opened the little door.
"Mac," she called, "get over here. You have to see this. Get Maud, too, or tell her to call Larry."
She thought about this for a minute.
"Or the police? I don't know.
What's up there?"
Mackenzie asked, alarmed. But something had apparently made Suna change her mind. She was now scrambling toward Mackenzie, shooing her down the stairs.
"Go, go, go!"
Mackenzie didn't need much convincing. She turned and all but pushed Maud to the bottom, and the three of them tumbled back into the hallway, shutting the attic door just as the familiar stomping started up with even more ferocity than usual. Suna pulled her phone out and shakily tapped in her access code.
"What happened up there? What did you do to make them so mad?" Maud asked.
I told you it was ghosts. Did you see them?"
"Shh."
Suna's fingers froze, and so did Mackenzie's hand on the knob and Maud's mouth mid-admonition. Each woman thought, or hoped, she was imagining it at first. The sound that began like fork tines dragging across a porcelain plate, culminating in an anguished, guttural scream. It died away and rose again, swelling and subsiding in waves as the ceiling thudded like something was trying to break through.
"What did you do?"
whispered Maud. But Suna just whimpered. The sound carried on through her head, and it felt like down into her legs, where it sat so heavy she couldn't move her feet. Then, a muffled click, and a faraway voice in a heavy southern drawl.
911, what is your emergency?
2139, said Suna.
She looked frantically at Maud, who was still frozen, then Mackenzie, who just shook her head. Was it the fear? Or the noise that made them all forget which street they lived on? Or were the ghosts able to scramble brainwaves?
"Ma'am?"
The voice of the 911 operator sounded loud, and it was only then that Mackenzie realized the screaming had stopped. Suna blushed and almost dropped the phone.
"I'm sorry," she said,
so quietly that Mackenzie could barely hear her.
"There's someone in my house, in the attic."
Aging Spirits. Suna. Suna hoped Maud wouldn't say anything to the police about ghosts in the attic. She wanted them to take her seriously at least long enough to go up there. Suna ran down the stairs to wait on the porch and jumped up to greet the officers as they walked up the steps. "Afternoon," said one of the officers, a smiling woman with her hair pulled tightly into a bun at her neck. "I'm Officer Seals, and this is Officer Bulawayo. We're looking for Maud Mitch. Is she home?" Suna frowned. "Yeah, but I'm the one who made the call," she said. Officer Seals looked genuinely shocked. "You made the calls?" she said. "Yeah," said Suna, disconcerted. "I did." The officers seemed in no hurry to follow her into the house. What part of 911 didn't they understand?
"Ma'am," said Officer Bulawayo, "you do realize this is a serious offense."
"Yeah," said Suna. "That's why I called 911. The officers furrowed their brows and exchanged glances. A second police car pulled up. The male officers who had come to the house the last time emerged, and they were in no hurry either.
"Hey, Shelby, Eva, you guys got this one?"
"Yeah. We came to talk to Mrs. Mitch about the bomb threats, but this lady says it was her all along."
All four officers stared at Suna, who suddenly felt sure she was dreaming, as though this day had not already felt like one weird, long dream.
I called 911. About the attic. I have people in my attic. I called 911. I didn't make any threats. Ever."
"Oh, I see," said Officer Seals. "So you two..." She stepped aside so the other officers could get past.
"Well, we still need to talk to Ms. Mitch. Is she..."
"Come on up," said Suna. "She's upstairs. Everyone's upstairs." Mackenzie was still standing in exactly the same place as when the screaming started. Maud stood by the attic door.
"Maud," said Suna, "these officers are here to see you."
"Good," said Maud. "So just up these stairs."
"Maud Mitch?"
said Shelby Seals. Maud nodded.
"Yes. So just up these stairs."
"Ma'am, we have reason to believe you've been calling in bomb threats."
Suddenly, Maud seemed to understand what was happening and began to panic.
"But I'm not the janitor, and that hat was stolen."
"Pardon? No one said you were the janitor, ma'am."
Mackenzie pointed at the attic, her face serious.
"I think you have your calls mixed up. We're the ones with the ghosts."
The officers all looked at each other.
"That would be us," said one of the men, looking skeptical.
"Okay," said Shelby. "But we're here to talk to you, Ms. Mitch."
"For sure," said Mackenzie. "But we called 911 because there's something freaky going on in our attic. Can we deal with that first?"
Shelby shrugged.
"That's fine."
She moved to stand beside Maud and motioned for the men to carry on with their business. Suna pointed to the door.
"Up here," she said to the officers. "There's a crawl space, but it has a trap door in the ceiling. You have to crawl to the farthest corner and then push up. It opens into..."
She realized she hadn't told Maud and Mackenzie what she'd seen.
A living room, with a couch and chairs and pictures on the walls and these deep red rugs on the floor and just it's lived in, she told them.
Just like... She motioned toward Maud's living room, though that room still only had a couch.
"No, not like that," she said, almost laughing. "More lived in, and there were paintings everywhere. Everywhere. And there was a fireplace," she said.
Then she shuddered.
"There was a fire burning in the fireplace, and there were people."
"You saw someone?"
Mackenzie swayed slightly, like the top of a skyscraper.
"Yeah," Suna said.
Did she believe in ghosts? What if they went up there and the living room Suna had just seen was just a dusty old attic full of trunks and cobwebs and bare floors, and what she had seen was some kind of glimpse into... into what? The ghost's world? Was that how it worked? She didn't watch enough horror movies to know.
Well, said the officer, this might surprise you ladies, but this does happen from time to time. People sneak into attics knowing the owner of the house doesn't go up there much, and they just move right in. Free rent. Sometimes they have some kind of reason for choosing a particular home, but often it's just a place to stay.
Okay, said Suna. I believe that, but how many people are we talking? And do they usually furnish the attics? Do they hang pictures on the walls? Install fireplaces? Just go look.
The men nodded. One of them stepped forward and knocked on the attic door. Hello, he called. This is the police. If there's anyone up there, I'm going to need to ask you to come down. Otherwise, we will be coming up in a moment.
He waited. The officers nodded again, then clomped up the stairs one after the other. She heard muffled footsteps as their heavy shoes crossed the floor above. Suna shivered and wished there were more officers. Maud and Mackenzie had moved close enough that she could reach out and put an arm around each of them. That was comforting. She sneaked a peek at Maud, wondering what she would do if Suna put an arm around her, or hugged her, for that matter. Probably die of shock. But then, Suna thought, hugging Maud wouldn't be the worst thing. And if Maud hugged back, it would be sincere, no doubt about that. This was the thing about Maud. She didn't pretend. A hug that really, for sure, meant something would be quite a beautiful thing. Suna suddenly kind of wished that Maud would actually hug her. Shouts and a couple of loud thuds came from the attic. People falling? The sound of running. Lots of running. The officers, probably. But there were more footsteps than just theirs. Lots more. Shouting. Scuffling. A bang. A gunshot? No, the trap door slamming against the floor. A voice. Authoritative.
I have a gun! Stop or I'll shoot!
The scuffling stopped. So someone has a gun out? Suna said, sounding infinitely calmer than she felt. Should we run? What do we do? Maud's eyes twitched in the direction of the door, but she backed up instead.
If they're coming down, maybe we'll be safer if we're not in their way. Maybe they'll all just run out the front door.
A good thought. Whatever was in the attic was being flushed out.
It's not ghosts.
Mackenzie sounded oddly disappointed. Maud shook her head, her face ashen and her hands shaking. Suna could tell she was much more afraid of this tangible thing than she'd ever been of ghosts. Maybe Maud had never really believed in ghosts. Maybe she used them as an excuse so she didn't have to think about this other possibility. And now she was probably thinking about how someone had been living just up the flight of stairs, creeping through her apartment when she was asleep, taking the rings from her purse. Suna placed a hand on her shoulder, and Maud blinked at her, smiled. The three women backed toward the kitchen, their breath caught in a collective inhale. What would come out of the attic? No, that wasn't right anymore. Who? Who had been living above them all this time? The door opened, and one of the officers emerged, red-faced, but calm. Suna and Mackenzie exchanged glances. The man called up the stairs.
Okay, guys, come down nice and easy. I don't want any trouble from anyone.
He looked flustered.
Does anyone need help coming down?
I'm okay.
A strange hillbilly voice.
Giving me time, boy. I can only go so fast.
It's fine, said the policeman. Take your time. Don't need to deal with broken hips today on top of all this.
He looked at Suna and Maud and Mackenzie, linked together like an absurd paper chain. Suna's hand still rested on Maud's shoulder and her other around Mackenzie's.
Is your mom okay?
He asked, addressing Suna and Mackenzie.
Do you need to sit down?
He asked Maud.
I'm okay, croaked Maud.
Her eyes were suddenly watery.
Well, you might need to sit down when you see what's been going on in your attic, he said,
adjusting his hat and, Suna thought, trying not to laugh. The bottom stair creaked. Suna anticipated some kind of hardened criminal, or a ghoul. It was hard not to dismiss that thought completely. She'd only seen feet in her quick glimpse of the secret attic room.
"Oh," said Mackenzie,
looking as she often did like she hadn't meant to say anything.
A tiny old man, who mostly consisted of rambling white facial hair, hobbled out into the hallway, breathing hard and glaring at the police officer. His legs were spindly and spider-like, and his feet stuck out to the sides at a strange angle.
"He ain't come down these stairs in 10 years, he said,
mumbling around the pipe in his mouth.
"Giving me just one more and you could have carried me out in a body bag."
The room went completely still as the man stopped next to the officer, coughing and sighing like being arrested was a huge inconvenience. The three housemates stared at him, unsure how to feel at this revelation. The officer handcuffed him and read him his rights. The man just rolled his eyes and issued a steady stream of complaints. Soon, another figure appeared in the doorway. It was, much to everyone's surprise, another elderly man, also bearded and spidery, blinking and grumbling his way into the brightly lit hallway. He wore a plaid flannel shirt and looked only slightly more kempt than the first man, as though he actually left the attic from time to time. He nodded at Maud, winked at Suna, ignored Mackenzie. On his heels was another old man, but this one had a surprise on his arm. A stunning, ancient lady, all done up in bright pink lipstick and blue eyeshadow and diamond earrings. She was smiling, like she was the queen, and everyone here had come to look at her. The couple leaned on each other and shuffled forward. The last person in this odd procession was a stately old woman who held her chin so high Suna worried she might trip over her feet. Atop her head was Maud's saucer-shaped hat. She was followed closely by the other policeman, who did indeed have a gun. Maud gasped.
"It's her," she whispered to Suna. "The ghost in my kitchen. The woman from the obituary. And she has my hat."
The woman cast a glance in their direction, and when she saw Maud, she smiled. Not a rude or unpleasant smile, not a sheepish one either. It was knowing. She recognized Maud, too. It was the same look the busker had given Suna the other day in front of Paper Cup. This realization hit Suna like ice water, and her eyes darted to the old man who'd winked at her. Sure enough, he held her gaze now with that same recognition. The man from downtown on the day of the bomb threats. The busker. The fellow who walked in circles around and around and around their house and, as it turned out, lived just up the stairs behind that locked door. The second last will and testament of Rebecca Finley. Larry. Larry was a music reviewer now. He had one gig, but it was a gig, a paid writing gig, and he was working on a piece to send to Razor Cake. A now and then kind of essay on how the punk scene had changed over the past 30 years. He was going to wait to send that one off until he had a chance to sit down with Mackenzie again and pick her brain. Sometime when she wasn't doing freelance marriage counseling or whatever weird thing he'd stumbled upon the other day. Maybe see if she could give him a referral. He felt very optimistic about the whole thing. He felt cool. He felt cool, but he did not look cool. He stood in front of the small mirror in his bathroom, turning his head and examining his chin-length, mud-brown hair. It was stringy and greasy and streaked with grays. It made him look conspicuously middle-aged. Everything made him feel middle-aged lately, and he hated it. Would his old hair help? Larry missed his mohawk. Almost without considering it at all, he retrieved his razor from the vanity drawer and shaved the area above his right ear. A cartilage piercing he'd sort of forgotten about sprang out at him. He liked it. He grinned and shaved another stripe. And then, purely because this was the worst moment for something else to demand his attention, the phone rang. Suna again. He didn't even care very much this time. He cared so little he almost didn't care at all. Almost.
"Hi, Larry," she said.
"Hi," he said, in his best not caring voice, which was a bit breathier than he would have liked. Maybe too high. Did he sound desperate?
"Are you busy right now?"
He looked at the small mound of hair on the counter. "I don't care. I don't care at all." "Yeah," he said. "I am busy." He felt proud of himself. He didn't need a pointless crush on a woman who didn't care about him, especially someone so mainstream. Wasn't that what the entire punk scene was about? Rejecting the mainstream? Individuality and nonconformity and brash, bold self-confidence, flying in the face of what society perceived to be beautiful? He looked into the mirror again and lifted his chin.
"Okay," said Suna. "Well, I just wanted to let you know that the police are here arresting all the old people who are living in that secret apartment in your attic."
"Okay," he said. "Hmm," he said. "Wait, say that part again?" he said.
"Which part?"
"Just all of it," said Larry. He must have misheard her. "Start it. Hi, Larry." Within minutes, he was on his way to his house. He had owned it for 3 months now, and more than ever, he wished it was a 1974 Lincoln Continental. "Told you, Glenda." He had to make his way through a maze of onlookers and police cars. The women stood on the porch, looking dazed and talking to a policeman. Mackenzie waved him over. "This is the landlord," she told the policeman. Larry, you will not believe."
"I told him," said Suna. "On the phone."
"Yeah, about the old folks' home he's running in the attic. But did you tell him about his aunt?"
"Oh, no, I didn't tell him that."
"Suna," Mackenzie laughed. "That's kind of the most important part." "Auntie?" Larry interjected, then caught himself, looking quickly at Suna. Suddenly he remembered the bald patch above his ear. He reached up to cover it, though it was certainly much too late. "My aunt? What about my aunt?"
"She's in that police car over there," said Mackenzie.
Larry laughed politely. "Oh, then it's not my aunt," he said. "My aunt passed away recently. Actually, funny thing, she's the one who left me this house." "Sir," said the police officer, "it would appear we have quite the situation on our hands. Your aunt is very much alive and is in fact sitting in that police cruiser. She's been living in the attic along with her husband and..." "Her husband?" Larry forgot all about his bald spot. "No, that can't be right either. Uncle Garnet's been dead for well over..." "Uncle Garnet," the officer interrupted, "is in that cruiser, there." He pointed toward the car with the flannel-shirted man. Larry stared at the officer as though he'd just asserted that Uncle Garnet had been reincarnated as a jelly bean. "Wait, what did you just say? Uncle Garnet and Aunt Rebecca have been living in the attic?" Everyone nodded with matching enthusiasm. "But what about the ghosts?" Even as he said it, he understood why his aunt had wanted him to stay out of the attic. That it was Uncle Garnet who hated Celine Dion and liked sports. The officer seemed to be enjoying himself.
Mr. Finley.
"Ah, you're a Finley too, okay. So, Mr. Finley, I have quite the fantastic little family history lesson for you here. Your Uncle Garnet," he snorted, "is an artist."
"Was an artist," corrected Larry stubbornly.
"When he died back in, what, 07, 08?
08.
Yes, 08. When he died in 08, your aunt was in charge of his body of work. She waited a few years and then tried to sell his paintings. The two of them thought the paintings would gain value because the artist was dead. People tend to think that's how it works."
"That's not how it works?" Maud interjected.
"No," said the officer. "If no one knows who you are before you die, they just seem to keep on not knowing who you are after. So he died for no good reason. And then because faking your own death comes with a lot of, well, legal baggage, he just stayed dead.
But no, he was dead. Actual dead. Real dead. There was a body. They cremated him.
Death kits,
hollered Maud, causing Larry to jump.
Did he buy a death kit?
The officer stared at her. I don't know, he said. We'll have to look into it. Maud nodded smugly at Suna.
Probably, she said to the officer, because you can buy death kits in Manila.
I'm sure you can, said the officer, looking a bit concerned. There's quite the underground market for, well, all kinds of crazy stuff. Lots of ways to fake your own death.
Okay, said Larry impatiently. Go on.
So he moved into the attic and your aunt lived in the house as normal. Tried to sell his work, but couldn't. That's why they hatched this guerrilla art exhibit plan. They were going to dig up into the building and put his work up in an empty gallery. One last shot at fame and fortune. Your cousin Jim was in on it, too. Your aunt left him quite the body of work in her will. He was going to sell it, split the money with them, and then they were going to retire to... He pulled out his notepad and read. Somewhere hot, but not annoying, and much bigger than that thar attic.
Your aunt, said Maud, almost got me arrested. She wore my hat and used my credit card when she went to buy a new burner phone. She was making calls from our attic, so on their computer thing, it looked like they were coming from me. I was really lucky she was here when the police came to arrest me. And that she still had my hat and my credit card and the cell phone they thought was mine.
She looked at everyone in the little circle meaningfully.
It wasn't mine, she added.
But you say 5 people, said Larry. He felt upset, very upset. He was a quiet kind of guy. He didn't ask for trouble. This felt like a lot of trouble. He wanted to set the whole house on fire and just walk away, although that would just get him into more trouble. He was not half as punk as he wished. She said 5 people in the attic. He was whining like a middle-aged woman who'd been cut in front of in line at Costco.
Yes, she did, said the officer. We're sorting it all out. At this point, all I can tell you is that there were 5 people, including your aunt and uncle, living in that house, but mostly that attic for about a decade. They had a fully furnished suite up there. They were quite comfortable. Your uncle moved in first. He had a friend, a notorious bank robber from Alberta, who also moved in at some point. His wife joined them, and then one of his buddies from the States. Not sure they all faked their deaths. Maybe. Don't know yet. And then when they decided enough time had passed, your aunt joined them up there.
The officer looked up reverently, as though he was referring to heaven and not the attic. Why are they being arrested? Is it a crime to fake your own death?
No. Well, there are certain ways to do it that are surprisingly not illegal. But it does need to be investigated because there are also certain ways to do it that are very illegal. Squatting, however, is illegal.
Is it squatting when you own the house?
The officer stared at Larry dumbly.
Because, said Larry, if the owners of this house are both alive, this isn't my house, is it?
Afraid not, said the officer. But then he clicked his tongue and frowned. Actually, I don't know. Maybe it is. I can't say I've ever seen someone come back from the dead to reclaim what they've left to others in their will. This is quite the situation.
Larry pulled out his key ring. He slipped off the house key and handed it to the officer. Well, I'll save everyone the trouble, he said. I'm not going to put up a fight. You just give that to my Aunt Rebecca.
He held both of his hands up and started backing away from the group.
Tell her I've already said my goodbyes to both her and Uncle Garnet. At their funerals. Funerals are for saying goodbye. You say goodbye, and then that's it. You don't say hello after that.
He ran his hand along the bare skin on his head.
Okay, I have to go finish doing my hair.
He nodded at his tenants. His tenants? His aunt's tenants? And stalked back to his car, trying not to look into the patrol cars.
Taking the house back. Suna.
What do you figure?
Mackenzie was sitting on the curb, looking up at their house.
Though it was now decidedly ghost-free, it was an even more terrifying place now. It had broken trust with them. What else was hiding in there? It was easy to imagine that the curtains were moving, that wherever she looked, something had just floated by.
"What do you mean?"
Suna asked.
"I mean, are you sleeping here tonight?"
"Hadn't really thought about it. I don't really have any other options. I don't know anyone else here other than people at the gym." Suna squinted at the attic windows. "But I think we're on the same page. I don't want to sleep here tonight either."
Maud was confused. "What's wrong with you two? The house is cleared of ghosts and robbers for the first time since we all moved in. This is the first night I actually feel safe staying here."
"What are you talking about, Maud?"
Suna smiled. "You were the only one who wasn't afraid of the ghosts."
"No," Maud corrected her. "I was petrified. I just never said so. To you. I'm not scared anymore. It's safe now."
"But it's so creepy," said Mackenzie. "It's creepy knowing that the whole time we've lived in this house, there have been 5 other people living here too, and that they could just go wherever they wanted, whenever. I think they had secret passageways. They came into my apartment more than once without ever moving the chair."
"And they knew us," said Suna, thinking of the busker. "They recognized us. They played pranks on us. They took my library books."
"They took my shoes," said Mackenzie, shivering.
"Well, that's true. But they also left you flowers," said Maud. "They took food out of my fridge, which was terribly rude."
"Speaking of that, I'm sorry for accusing you two of stealing my rings. I should have known you wouldn't do that."
She said this more into her shoulder than to the other two women. Suna and Mackenzie nodded.
"It's all good," said Mackenzie. "I'm just glad it's sorted out."
"It's all good," echoed Maud, like she thought this was a funny thing to say.
"Same," said Suna.
"And you know, you're both welcome to sleep over at my place tonight if you want. I mean, no pressure, but if..."
"Yes, please," said Mackenzie. "I'd rather not be alone tonight. Maud?"
Maud was distracted, staring at someone in the diminishing crowd of gawkers and police officers. He wasn't coming toward them, but they could all tell he was watching Maud out of the corner of his eye. He was rocking back on his heels and toes with his hands in his pockets, perhaps trying to appear nonchalant but failing miserably. Suna put a hand on Maud's elbow.
"Hey, Maud."
"What?" Maud snapped. Suna was surprised, even though it hadn't been all that long since Maud had spoken to her that way.
"Are you going to tell me to slap him across the face and ask him to leave me alone? File a restraining order? Are you going to tell me I can't talk to him like you know what's best for me and I don't? Because why? Because no one takes me seriously anymore? Or is it because he messed up? Well, I mess up sometimes too. And if everyone stopped loving me every time I messed up, no one would love me."
"Oh, wait."
"Maud," Suna said, "I'm sorry. I'm really sorry. I was only going to say that in the car earlier, I could tell you didn't think you'd done the right thing."
Maud relaxed just a little. She stared at Suna's hand, still on her elbow.
"That's true," she said. "I don't think I did the right thing. But what would have been right? Is there a right thing?"
Suna laughed. "No," she said. "This isn't exactly a moral dilemma. It's just whether you believe him and accept his apology or not, and whether you want him or not. I think I was trying to answer those questions for you. And I'm sorry I did that. I shouldn't have."
Maud considered this.
"It's all good," she said. Suna thought it seemed like she was trying to emulate Mackenzie this time, not mock her.
"And you're right. If you don't give a second chance, you don't get one either, right?"
"True," said Suna. They all looked at Richard, who was still rocking on his feet, back and forth, pretending to look at the house or at the police cars, anything but Maud. He was very much looking at Maud.
"That's good," said Mackenzie, as they watched Maud cross the street.
"I guess so."
"What, you don't like love? You don't think it's cute? Maud and Richard?"
"Nah, it's good. You're right. What about you?"
"Me? What about me?"
They watched as Maud leaned into Richard and he put his arms around her. Mackenzie grinned.
"Jared," said Suna. "Does watching them make you wish you'd asked him more questions?
Gotten more answers? Or was a punch in the face enough? Mackenzie's smile faded and she shook her head.
I think that's part of being an adult, you know? Your life is just frayed at the edges, and you have whole haunted cities full of people who owe you explanations and apologies. Cities full of ghosts. The end.
That's depressing. Suna leaned back on her elbows and sprawled out on the cement. Okay, but here's a question. Where do ghosts come from?
What do you mean?
I mean, where do ghosts come from?
Mackenzie shrugged. Dead people?
Suna shook her head.
Okay, cemeteries?
Nope.
Out of thin air? Attics? I don't know, Suna. I think the actual question is whether ghosts exist in the first place.
Suna began to nod vigorously. Exactly. Exactly, Mac. If ghosts do exist, I don't know where they come from. But I feel like they don't. Call me a skeptic, whatever. I just don't think they exist. And if ghosts don't exist, this question actually has a super easy answer. So, Mac, where do they come from?
Mackenzie was lost. Your imagination?
Right. Exactly. You're talking about cities full of ghosts, and I say those ghosts all only exist in your imagination. Like, take Richard and Modikins over there. He was her ghost, and he haunted her for years. It changed her, to the point where he didn't even recognize her when he saw her again. But really, she could have just called him the day after their wedding, not to beg him to come back even, just to ask where he'd gone. Or she could have let him go without even involving him in the process. You know what I mean? Same with me and Brett. I let her be my ghost. I conjured her spirit up and let it haunt me all this time. But my obsessing over her like that never made her real, didn't impact her reality at all. She's off living the dream, maybe thinking about me, probably not, while I'm stuck living this haunted life, miserable. And you and Jared, same thing.
But not Cade and Tanya, said Mackenzie. That's different.
No, said Suna, getting excited. I mean, it's different, but it's also the same. The ghost isn't the person. It's the feelings attached to the person. It's like my ghost wasn't Brett. My ghost was the hurt I felt that someone I considered family could desert me like that, and the worry that that was going to be the story of my life, forever. With you and Kate and Tanya, your ghosts are guilt and fear, and you're hanging on to them because you're afraid the truth will hurt your relationship with your parents. And you know what? It already has, whether they're aware of it or not. But hurt relationships can be fixed. Exhibit A. She pointed at Maud and Richard again, still hugging. She rolled her eyes, though she was smiling at them. Mackenzie stared at them too, unconvinced.
But then, closure. Is it real?
Totally. And it's way easier than we thought. Because you don't need the other person. What we're looking at right now, with Maud and Richard, that's not closure. I think I was right after all. She got closure back there in the coffee shop. That's why this can happen now. She told her ghost to get lost, and now there's room for Richard again. Mackenzie still looked doubtful. Mac, Suna cried. You, of all people, know how much it sucks to live in fear of ghosts, only to find out they're just five cantankerous but harmless old people with broken dentures and white hair. Take your house back. So it wasn't a perfect metaphor, but it was good enough for Suna. For the first time in years, she felt decidedly unhaunted. Maud's wedding, a few months later. Maud and Richard. It was Maud's wedding day, and she looked awful in her dress. Even worse, objectively speaking, than she had the first time she'd worn it. She looked in the mirror on the back of Suna's bedroom door. Her face was pinched and sharp and hollow and sagging and grayish and whiskery. She made her mouth smile, and the skin around her eyes bunched up like sweatpants with the drawstring pulled tight. She sighed, more bunching on the forehead. She thought about mirrors. A mirror was designed so a person could see their own face. A face, with its eyes and nose and mouth and ears on the side, was designed to perceive the world, not to perceive itself.
And what did people do? They made a thing that would block the world in front of them and replace that view with their own reflection. There was nothing wrong with mirrors. They were, Maud thought, just unhelpful. She decided to look at this face for one more minute, only to make sure there wasn't lipstick on the teeth or mascara on the cheekbones. She would look objectively, like she was looking at a stranger. Then she would turn away and think about all the things that were actually important about this day. This time, she saw the face differently. It was the face of a woman who was sharply aware that her wedding day could take any number of tragic turns, that she could end up alone in the end again, but it wasn't a face that expected to. It was not a face without fear, but it was not without hope either. It was a face entering into marriage with reverence and solemnity and still joy. It was a human face, beautiful in its intricacy and emotion. She had compassion for it, and she understood, suddenly, why Richard touched this face when he said, "I love you." Until now, she'd thought maybe he was trying to make her feel good, or that it was a gesture he'd seen on enough romantic movies that he did because he thought he was supposed to. Now, she realized he'd been saying it because he meant it, and he'd been touching her face because it belonged to her. Simple as that. "You ready, Modikins?" asked Suna, peering around the bedroom door. "Wow, you look really beautiful." "Thank you," said Maud, blinking furiously.
Are you okay?"
Suna took a step forward cautiously.
"Did something happen?"
"No," said Maud. "Well, yes." Suna looked around the bedroom, as though Richard might be hidden somewhere. She raised an eyebrow. "Just something internal," said Maud, trying to dab her eyes without wrecking Suna's careful makeup application. "Just one of those moments, you know, when you have no new information, but your brain rearranges all of what you do have, and it suddenly makes sense." Suna nodded, her eyes wide.
"Okay? Like about today, or?"
Maud gave a short laugh. "Yes, I suppose it is about today." Suna was still nodding, blatantly uncomprehending. "It's just that when Richard left me that first time, I didn't think it was for any one reason. I thought it was for all of them. Every time I found a flaw in myself after that, I just added it to the list of reasons Richard left me. It was my face and my body and my mind and my sense of humor and my hair. All of the things that made me me. And you know what I did? I ghosted myself. Or," she frowned at Suna, "ghosted on myself? Not so sure of the grammar around that word just yet." She sat on Suna's bed, plucking a Kleenex from the box on the night table. She began to get weepy again. "Does that make sense to you, though? I was perfectly fine with myself until he left, and then I began to just hate every single thing. And before I knew it, I'd shrugged it all off and become someone who just sat in her apartment and watched old detective shows on VHS. Suna nodded, as though she could relate to what Maud was saying. It was nice of her to display some empathy, Maud thought. Not that there's anything wrong with those old shows, but it was the principle of it, Suna. It was the fact that I would so quickly abandon my own life, betray my own self, disappear without a trace like that just because I thought that my completely irrational reasons for doing so trumped all else. You and Mackenzie and I have all been so livid that other people did those things to us. But I did those things to myself, Suna." Suna wasn't nodding anymore. She sat on her bed beside Maud and stared at her fingernails. "And you know what?" Maud went on. "I feel dumb for taking this long to figure out that I don't have to be any particular way that I wasn't already before he fell in love with me. That just because someone leaves you, that doesn't mean that you are not still perfectly fine and valuable, and it definitely doesn't mean you should leave yourself. This is a lesson for a teenager, and," she picked the heavy skirt of her dress up and let it fall, "this is a dress for a 25-year-old, and here I am, learning that lesson in this dress. It's embarrassing.
Suna put her hand on Maud's shoulder.
Nah, she said. It's great. It's the perfect lesson to learn on the first day of your married life. And even if you had learned it as a teenager, you just have to learn it again and again between then and now, like the rest of us, like me. I mean, I just learned it again right now, from you. So, thanks.
They smiled at each other.
I think you're in the BLZ, Maud, said Suna.
Maud blinked at her.
I don't know what that means, she said.
I love that about you, said Suna. And I'm going to miss having you upstairs.
No, you're not, said Maud, sniffling again. You're just going to miss sneaking into my house and stealing my takeout.
There was a knock on the door, and Richard poked his head into the room. He looked startled when he saw Suna.
Oh, sorry. Am I interrupting?
Suna stood up.
Nope. I should actually go see what I can do to help. I think Mac's making lunch for after the ceremony.
Mackenzie and Grant. Suna found Mackenzie in the kitchen, but she wasn't making lunch. She was sitting on the counter, holding her phone in the palms of her hands like she was weighing it.
What are you doing, Mac?
I don't know. Just waiting for stuff to start.
Like, the wedding, you mean?
Yeah, the wedding.
She gave Suna a look like, of course the wedding, what else?
Oh, I just thought you were being sort of melodramatic or something, like just sitting here waiting for my life to start or whatever.
Mackenzie laughed.
That too, I guess. I do kind of get like that at weddings.
How so?
Suna hopped up on the counter beside her.
Well, you know, the whole point of this day is that we're all here just watching someone arrive. Marriage is like a conclusion. And I guess it just makes me think about all my loose ends.
Jared?
No, not Jared. No.
Mackenzie laughed again, harder this time.
Though now that you mention it, I wonder how that poor Lauren girl is doing.
Like you worry they broke up after that whole thing at the exchange?
No, like I worry they're still together. Poor girl.
Oh, gotcha. Yeah. So, who then?
Grant. A guy I worked with.
Oh, someone you dated?
No, almost. I threw up when he came to pick me up for our first date, and that was right before everything went down with my sister and the trial and all that, when I quit at Picaroon. And I haven't actually really gotten a chance to talk to him since.
He hasn't called or texted?
No, he has. Mackenzie leaned forward and put her head in her hands on top of the phone. Suna, you're going to just hate me for this.
You ghosted him.
Yup.
Suna shrugged.
Okay, so that was a bad move. Call him.
I can't now, it's been too long.
Is that what you would have said if the letter had been from Jared or Kate? Do you think that's what I would have said if it had been from Brett?
Mac,
think about whose wedding we're at right now.
Mackenzie considered this.
But what do I say?
Everything. Just say everything. Say what you wish Jared would have said to you. Say what Richard finally said to Maud. Explain. Apologize. Own it. You were a jerk. Ghosting is rude. If he gives you a second chance.
She nodded at the window that looked out into the backyard, where an arch and 20 white chairs were set up.
I marry him?
No, Mac!
Suna rolled her eyes.
You take the second chance. See what happens. Like Richard.
Richard appeared in the doorway of the kitchen, a millisecond too late to hear his name spoken.
Oh, Suna, there you are. Change of plans. It's just too cold out there for this backyard wedding business. We're going to do the ceremony inside. Maud finally relented. That lady is more stubborn than this prairie weather, but we finally got her to break.
He smiled.
The photographer says the lighting is terrible in the living room, though. And besides, the reception is all set up in there already, so we're going to do it.
He paused for dramatic effect.
Right here.
You're getting married in my kitchen?
They couldn't tell if he was joking or not.
I'm getting married in your kitchen, by this big window. Maud just wants a nice picture of us saying I do for over the fireplace. The photographer wants lots of natural light.
He hooked his arm through the air in front of him like an old-timey entertainer holding an invisible cane
and turned to leave.
Pass the word on to everyone you see.
They watched him scurry out into the hallway, as effervescent a man as either of them had ever seen. It was almost surprising that he didn't jump into the air and click his heels as he rounded the corner.
See, said Suna. You could make Grant that happy.
Or maybe he's gone out and got himself a friend like you who's going to put me through the ringer and then tell me to get lost.
Hopefully. It would serve you right, Mac.
Mackenzie laughed in spite of herself. Then she pulled out her phone and typed,
Hey.
Suna. Suna was in charge of answering the door and directing people to the kitchen. Not that there were many people to direct. The pastor and his wife and their 8-year-old son, Maud's sister Linda, and Linda's husband Harv, who was very short, they flew in from Ontario. Two of Richard's friends and his father Edward, who was in a wheelchair, which was why they were not getting married in Maud's kitchen upstairs. Larry and the photographer, the son of a friend of Richard's who everyone was just calling photographer like it was an inside joke. It was not a big crowd for a wedding, but it was a big crowd for a kitchen. It was a big kitchen for cooking, but not a big kitchen for, say, marrying. The pastor stood in front of the fridge. Maud and Richard stood in front of the pastor. The photographer stood in front of Maud and Richard. The pastor's wife and son stood in the back beside the stove. His father sat at the table, and Harv and Linda and one of Richard's friends took the 3 chairs. The other friend stood in the back by the pastor's son. Mackenzie sat on the countertop by the sink. Larry stood in the corner with his hands in the pockets of some strange, terribly altered pinstripe pants. Suna stood in the doorway.
Well, you ready, Maudikins?
Maud sniffed. Maudikins, she said under her breath. Richard, chuckling, opened his mouth to speak, but Maud jabbed him in the ribs. No, only Suna gets to call me that. She nodded to the pastor. Okay, Kevin, we're ready. The pastor smiled. He was one of those relaxed pastors who was okay being called Kevin instead of Pastor Kevin or Father Kevin or whatever.
All right, he said. Let's get this show on the road. Maud, Richard, we're gathered here today in front of this lovely stainless steel Frigidaire in the presence of all of your...
The doorbell rang.
Who rings a doorbell in the middle of a wedding ceremony?
Maud looked annoyed.
I'll get it, said Suna.
She opened the door to a stranger, a woman with chin-length neon purple hair poking out from under a knit hat, and large brown eyes, her face decorated all over with tiny silver hoops and studs. She was wearing a large winter jacket, open despite the chill, over ripped black jeans and a white t-shirt that had Fugazi scrawled on the front in fading black Sharpie. Not the kind of thing you'd normally wear to a wedding.
Oh,
the woman squeaked, stepping into the small interior landing and stomping on the welcome mat to get the snow off her boots.
It's you.
Suna frowned.
Yeah,
she said. It is. The woman must have realized she wasn't recognized back.
I used to see you at the Cup, like, all the time. I go there on my coffee breaks. I work at the crematorium next door.
Suna realized then that it had never occurred to her once in her whole life that people worked at crematoriums, same as people worked at gyms and flower shops and pizza parlors.
Oh, she said. Yeah, I saw you out front. I thought you were there for... You know, because somebody close to you had...
I have kind of a weird question for you. The woman interrupted Suna, and Suna was thankful for it. There was a muffled but distinct clinking sound, and Suna realized it was a tongue piercing moving against the woman's teeth. Is there a guy who lives in this house who's, like, tall and has a goatee, and he has, a lot of piercings? She pointed at her own face. And, like, he's got longish hair? This is super embarrassing. I don't remember his name. But when I met him, he was telling someone how he just inherited a big house on this street. She couldn't stop touching her face, playing with her hair. Suna smiled kindly at the woman.
Yeah, she said. I mean, yeah, I know who you're talking about. But he doesn't live here. He's the landlord.
Funny story, actually. He inherited the house from his dead aunt, and then she ended up being alive, so he uninherited it, but then she went to jail, so it's his again. Until she gets out, I think.
And then, I actually don't know what happens then. She laughed. It's been a bit of a trip. You looking for a place? I don't know how much longer it'll be available, depending on what happens with Larry's aunt. The woman looked surprised. Oh, no. No, I'm not. I actually met him at the grocery store in the summer. He asked for my number, and then he was gone before I could give it to him. She looked up and stopped short. Oh, you've got a lot of company. Richard and Mackenzie had followed Maud into the hallway, and Richard's two friends peered curiously from the doorway. The photographer snapped a picture. The woman with the purple hair cleared her throat, wary of the large group. I did leave him a note in the mailbox, but maybe he didn't ever get it if he doesn't even live here. She began to laugh, but trailed off and bit her lip, looking embarrassed. I probably seem like a creep, but also, I kind of laughed at him when he asked for my number, and I felt really stupid about it. I wasn't laughing at him, you know, I was just nervous. I just thought, oh, said Suna, who had just turned to call Larry from the kitchen. She froze. It was you. Yeah, this was a really weird thing to do, come here. I should just... She motioned at the porch steps and began to back toward them. But by this point, Larry had found his way into the hallway, and when he saw who was standing in the entryway, his face stretched into a grin that made him look like some kind of stupid bird. Hey! The woman let out a relieved laugh when she saw him. Hey, she said again. Hi, I'm Nikki. I actually don't know your name. Larry said over Richard's shoulder. Larry Finley. No way, Nikki called back. As in the music reviewer from the Gopher?
Yeah.
Larry was beside himself.
Yeah, that's me.
I love your column, Nikki said. It's refreshing to have someone who knows what they're talking about doing that gig. Maud cut in. I'm sorry, she snipped, in a voice reminiscent of the Maud Suna had met on the porch a few months ago. I'm getting married. Oh, Nikki grimaced. I'm in your way. No, said Maud. I'm getting married in here. You can come. You can be Larry's date, but you need to hurry it up. Richard winked at Nikki as they all shuffled back into the kitchen and took up their places once again.
Yes, hurry it up. We have a reception we need to get to in the living room, he said.
Oh, stop, Richard, Maud mumbled, but she was smiling. Richard put his arm around her.
What's the rush, Maud? He said into her hair. We have the rest of our lives. Actually, that's, Kevin, can we hurry this up? I'm 72.
Maud burst out laughing. And unbeknownst to her, the photographer snapped a picture at that exact moment. He'd been right about the light from the window over the kitchen sink. It was perfect. A month later, when she saw the picture, Richard looking at her with shining eyes, her eyes shut, accentuating her laugh lines, her head bowed so that her double chin bulged out like she'd swallowed a pillow, mascara traveling onto the drooping skin above her eyes, even she couldn't say it wasn't a beautiful shot. And she would hang it above the fireplace. Kevin led the couple in exchanging vows and rings and pronounced them husband and wife. And then the group moved to the living room for the meal. When that was done, Suna asked if they were having a dance, and Maud said they weren't, but Suna started moving the rented tables anyway. One dance, she said. You at least need to do the first dance as husband and wife thing, just that. Maud begrudgingly agreed. Suna ran into her bedroom and brought out a Bluetooth speaker. Maud and Richard stood in the middle of the floor like a couple of teenagers at their first prom, shy about performing in front of the small crowd. What will you be dancing to? Asked Suna, wiggling her eyebrows. I don't know, said Maud. Just pick something. How about My Heart Will Go On?
Oh, isn't that by Celine Dion?
Larry blurted loudly.
I don't think...
Everyone looked at him, and he blushed.
Ha! Nothing, never mind,
he said, laughing. But then he couldn't stop laughing, even when the dance had begun, and he kept looking up at the ceiling. Suna watched him and Nikki sitting in the corner, Larry constantly looking upward at every creak, real and imagined, her gazing at him adoringly. Mackenzie hunched over her phone, texting with someone. Grant? Hopefully. Maud and Richard, awkwardly but sweetly, clutching each other's shoulders and swaying back and forth.
She thought about relationships and friendships and social media influencers, about ideal lives and real lives and BLZs and expectations and unexpected friendships and aging and plastic surgery, and how Richard looked at Maud like she was beautiful. She thought about what Maud had said about ghosting herself, and she thought about how she would miss Maud living just upstairs from her. She was kind of like Brett, in that unapologetic, speak-your-truth, no-holds-barred kind of way. She was kind of like family. The last notes of the song died away, and everyone clapped politely. Richard pulled Maud into a hug. The ceiling popped loudly, and it was probably just the wood expanding as the weather shifted, but everyone jumped.
"That woman," said Larry gravely, "is caterwauling like a banshee."
He'd probably meant to say it quietly, an inside joke with only himself, but it hung in the air for everyone to consider. And then, because it made so little sense, everyone laughed, like it was the funniest thing they'd ever heard. We hope you have enjoyed our presentation of Sorry I Missed You by Susie Kraus, performed by Amanda Ronconi. Performance copyright 2020 by Brilliance Publishing, Inc. All rights reserved. For further information concerning this program or other Brilliance audio titles, please visit our website at www.brilliancepublishing.com. No part of this recording may be played for an audience or reproduced in any form. It may not be streamed, downloaded, broadcast, or copied without written permission. Address all inquiries to Brilliance Audio, P.O. Box 887, Grand Haven, Michigan, 49417.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.